Messenger of the Lord. Chapter 29. Principles and Philosophy. Ellen White's able articulation of the role of Christian education as a prime vehicle for the transmission of religious values and purpose constitutes a profound theology of Christian education. Ellen G. White was recognized as the prophetic thought leader of Adventist education from its inception until her death in 1915. It is impossible to comprehend Adventist education either currently or historically without understanding the role and impact of Ellen White upon its development. She was not only a central figure in its development, but she was the only Adventist leader who was in constant prominence from its beginnings up through the end of its formative period, about 1910. Nowhere in the writings of Ellen White do we find the principles of the great controversy theme more explicitly unfolded than in her writings on educational principles. Her understanding of redemption as restoration lies at the heart of her educational philosophy. These educational principles were developed, on one hand, within the context of 19th century attempts to reform education, and on the other, within the denominational context of comparative indifference to education reform. Voices that attempted to reform educational systems in the 19th century sounded like lonely cries in the wilderness. The 19th century was a transition era from centuries of traditional thinking. In almost every area of American life, including theology, philosophy, medicine, industrialization, and education, the 19th century was in ferment. In education, the struggle focused on the old wineskins of classical education that focused on the words, ancient languages, and ideas, philosophies, of Western civilization. The educated person, as a common denominator, was expected to read and discuss the ancient poets and philosophers in Greek and Latin. However, the question was being asked, with the emergence of democratic ideas, more leisure time, and changing work conditions and expectations, was this elitist, bookish education meeting the needs of modern times? John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Heinrich Pestalozzi, and others had been saying, no, for several centuries, but their efforts made little dent in traditional education. However, two influences in the 19th century were significant and made some impact on Adventist educational reform. Horace Mann, 1796-1859, was perhaps the leader in establishing the need for the public school elementary system in the United States. He also wrote extensively on the early need for children to understand physiology and to get a practical education. The other major influence centered in educational experiments with manual labor coupled with the emphasis on biblical instruction rather than the traditional classics at certain academic institutions. Oberlin College, Ohio, the best known of these centers, promoted the Bible as a textbook in all the departments of education, integrated a manual labor program for all students, required physiology, and fostered a campus environment of non-competition in areas usually associated with prizes and honors. Its president/founder announced, "The system of education in this institute will provide for the body and heart as well as the intellect, for it aims at the best education of the whole man." But by the late 1850s, these remarkable educational reforms had lost their initial enthusiasm and their programs soon conformed to the prevailing pattern of other American colleges. Though Oberlin faded as a reforming institution, probably because it did not maintain a compelling spiritual context, other voices arose that emphasized a more practical education, progressive education, in unseating the classics with more useful subjects and in promoting manual education. The president of Johns Hopkins University in 1888 declared that manual training not only improved physical health but also increased mental vigor. But these voices were not mainstream. The similarity between Ellen White's educational reform message and that of a few clear voices of her time rests on the obvious fact that all those involved in educational reform were contending with the same problems, classic curricula rather than a more practical education, poorly ventilated, poorly lighted classrooms, direct relationship between manual training/exercise with mental vigor, even spiritual values, and education as an important factor in character development. Especially when Bible-oriented reformers attempted educational reform, one would expect general agreement on principles and practice. Ellen White understood this when in her book Education she wrote this remarkable summation of educational principles. "We can trace the line of the world's teachers as far back as human records extend, but the light was before them. As the moon and the stars of our solar system shine by the reflective light of the sun, so, as far as their teaching is true, do the world's great thinkers reflect the rays of the sun of righteousness. Every gleam of thought, every flash of the intellect, is from the light of the world. Is there anything unique about Ellen White's principles of education? Her special contribution lies in the unity and clarity of her educational philosophy, unencumbered with the fads and false leads of 19th century contemporaries. Although a few contemporaries also saw the religious purpose of education, Mrs. White placed education within the great controversy theme, including its vital role in eschatology, the study of last day events. Originality is not the test of a prophet. Dynamic freshness, coherence, and unity that harmonizes with the Bible is. Educational principles. Fatal errors of prevailing educational philosophies focus either on intellectual attainment, temporal success, or even correct behavior, hoping to develop the good that exists in man by nature. Ellen White drove past these flattering, self-serving purposes of education with the simple clarity that redemption is the object of education. Not wanting to leave this definition in an undefinable generality, she explained the biblical framework for connecting education with redemption. Note the four cornerstones. In order to understand what is comprehended in the work of education, we need to consider both the nature of man and the purpose of God in creating him. We need to consider also the change in man's condition through the coming in of a knowledge of evil, and God's plan for still fulfilling his glorious purpose in the education of the human race. This educational strategy can be understood only within the framework of the great controversy theme, first and constant aim of Christian education. Thus, for Christian teachers on whatever level, their first effort and constant aim should be 1. To aid the student in comprehending these principles, and 2. To enter into that relation with Christ which will make these principles a controlling power in the life. Ellen White reiterated often that the all-important thing in education should be the conversion of students. It is upon the foundation of the new birth experience that Christian education can proceed with its other aims and purposes. If it fails at the foundational and primary point, it has failed entirely. Fundamental aim sets agenda. This fundamental aim of education to restore the broken relationship between God and the student sets the educational agenda and curriculum. All the other purposes of education are enlightened and molded by this primary purpose. Christian teachers know that character education, not personality change in order to add to one's self-esteem or to assist in climbing the career ladder, seeks to restore the image of Christ in those placed under their care, towering motivation for reaching one's full potential. The great controversy theme leaves its mark on all phases of the Christian's life. Restoration is its key thought. The full development of all human capabilities is the goal before every Christian. The energy of heaven is promised to those who permit the heavenly current to flow, but that energy flows only in the direction of loving service. That is why Ellen White wrote that astounding sentence, "The development of all our powers is the first duty we owe to God and to our fellow men." Self-development, yes. But not to become number one. The pursuit of excellence? Yes. We should cultivate every faculty to the highest degree of perfection, that we may do the greatest amount of good of which we are capable. God will accept only those who are determined to aim high, and those who would be workers together with God must strive for perfection of every organ of the body and quality of the mind. True education is the preparation of the physical, mental, and moral powers for the performance of every duty. It is the training of body, mind, and soul for divine service. The pursuit of intellectual greatness. If students are challenged to reach to the highest point of intellectual greatness, if balanced by religious principle, dullness and ignorance are no virtue. The highest culture of the mind, if sanctified through the love and the fear of God, receives his fullest approval. All who engage in the acquisition of knowledge should strive to reach the highest round of the ladder. Let students advance as fast and as far as they can. Let the field of their study be as broad as their powers can compass, but let them make God their wisdom. Occupational skills imperative. Further, each student is to join intellectual pursuits with a knowledge of some trade or occupation by which, if need be, he may earn a livelihood. Learning an occupational skill was urged not merely to be prepared to earn a living if circumstances required such, but also to add vigor to mental studies and to provide a special opportunity for character growth. learning a trade would help produce a more elevated class of youth with stability of character. They would have perseverance, fortitude, and courage to surmount obstacles. In fact, if students had to make a choice between a knowledge of the sciences or a knowledge of labor for practical life, Mrs. White would unhesitatingly answer the latter. If one must be neglected, let it be the study of books. School curriculum must be organized to fulfill education's highest aim. The contrast between secular and Bible-centered curricula is seen most clearly in how the nature of human beings is perceived. Are we products of an evolutionary ascent, or are we created beings, made in the image of our Creator? Is education a matter of getting ahead and succeeding in a secular career, or is it a process of allowing our Creator to work out His original plan for human beings? Ellen White's many references to making the Bible a textbook in our schools meant that the Bible should be the basis of all education. The Bible should not be inserted into the curriculum, sandwiched in between infidelity to merely flavor other studies. Further, making the Bible the basis of education does not mean that it is to be the only textbook for classes such as arithmetic, languages, and geography. The Bible was not given to the human family to be its best encyclopedia, but it does give a worldview that helps to interpret and apply information. Ellen White noted that all academic disciplines, every area of thought, take on new significance when seen in the light of the great controversy theme. She meant that all classes must be taught within the framework of the biblical worldview, that every class should reflect the grand purpose of Christian education - to restore in man the image of his Maker. Essential courses of study. In addition to her emphasis on the biblical context for all classes, Ellen White asserted that physiology should be the first study in the educational program in order to preserve health. Vocal training would greatly increase the usefulness of every student. Speaking to both men and women, Ellen White wrote, "However imperfect may be your manner of utterance, you may correct your faults and refuse to allow yourself to have a nasal tone or to speak in a thick, indistinct way. If your articulation is distinct and intelligible, your usefulness will be greatly increased. Then do not leave one defective habit of speech uncorrected." Role of the parents as educators. Educational psychologists and sociologists are alarmed at what many call the most critical issue facing modern civilization, the disintegration of the family. Ellen White wrote much about the influence of the home for good or ill in the education of children. Neither parent should shift the responsibilities of educating the children to the other. Only by working in unison can the father and mother accomplish the work which God has committed to their hands. But the mother has a unique role. No other work can equal hers in importance. A surrogate mother is a poor substitute for a biological mother who pursues other goals. Why does the responsibility of educating children rest so heavily on parents, especially the mother? Why cannot outside-the-home services such as daycare centers and early kindergartens take the place of parents? Because lessons learned, the habits formed during the years of infancy and childhood, have more to do with the formation of character and the direction of the life than have all the instruction and training of after years. In fact, Mrs. White wrote, "The first 6 or 7 years of a child's life should be given to its physical training rather than the intellect. Parents, especially mothers, should be the only teachers of such infant minds." However, circumstances may require earlier schooling, as Ellen White made clear at St. Helena, California, in 1904. One of the startling misconceptions of modern times is that children need parents less after they start school, even after becoming adolescents. Higher education more than information. When Ellen White spoke of higher education, she meant more than schooling beyond the 12th grade. In fact, higher education had more to do with a religious experience than with advanced information. Higher education calls for something greater, something more divine, than the knowledge to be obtained merely from books. It means a personal, experimental knowledge of Christ. It means emancipation from ideas, from habits and practices that have been gained in the school of the Prince of Darkness. Mrs. White often emphasized that one should excel in literary and science studies but must not accomplish this to the neglect of religious experience. She wrote, "An intellectual religion will not satisfy the soul. Intellectual training must not be neglected, but it is not sufficient. Students must be taught that they are in this world to do service for God. They must be taught to place the will on the side of God's will. To her, both strict intellectualism, even theological understanding, without Christian commitment, are to be avoided. One of her frequent themes was that ignorance will not increase the humility or spirituality of any professed follower of Christ. Further, the truths of the divine word can be best appreciated by an intellectual Christian. Christ can be best glorified by those who serve him intelligently. The great object of education is to enable us to use the powers which God has given us in such a manner as will best represent the religion of the Bible and promote the glory of God. Teacher credibility. Mrs. White called for teachers who are able to bridge the gap between religion and theology, between experience and knowledge. The teacher of truth can impart effectively only that which he himself knows by experience. In fact, the teacher's personal habits and spiritual experience should be considered of even greater importance than his literary qualifications. Recreation as necessary as study and labor. A frequent theme in Ellen White's writings is her call for balance and moderation in most any activity of the Christian. For some who have heard only her call to diligence and perseverance in pursuing excellence, her emphasis on recreation may come as a shock. She wrote early in her ministry, "Recreation is needful to those who are engaged in physical labor, and is still more essential for those whose labor is principally mental. It is not essential to our salvation, nor for the glory of God, to keep the mind laboring constantly and excessively, even upon religious themes." Mrs. White used the word recreation in its best sense. She focused on the recreating purpose of withdrawing from the busy program of either mental or physical activity. She suggested, for example, that several families unite and make an excursion into the country with tasty and wholesome food in their baskets. What would these families do? She continued. Parents and children should feel free from care, labor, and perplexity. Parents should become children with their children, making everything as pleasant for them as possible. Let the whole day be given to recreation. But for Ellen White, recreation was not to be a spiritual vacation from Christian commitment. In her landmark book on education, Education, she devoted a chapter to recreation. In that chapter, she differentiated between recreation and amusement. Recreation, when true to its name, recreation, tends to strengthen and build up. Calling us aside from our ordinary cares and occupations, it affords refreshment for mind and body, and thus enables us to return with new vigor to the earnest work of life. Amusement, on the other hand, is sought for the sake of pleasure, and is often carried to excess. It absorbs the energies that are required for useful work, and thus proves a hindrance to life's true success. Compared to the pace of life in the 19th century, modern families live under much greater stress. One of the paradoxes is that today's families, though having more labor-saving devices, also live more tension-filled, schedule-driven lives than their forebears. Furthermore, very few professions in the Western world require physical activity. The need for recreation today is substantial, not only to take the mind off the business at hand, but to provide the physical exercise that good health requires. In other words, no people in history have ever needed planned recreation more. At the same time, perhaps no other people in history have ever been confronted with so much pseudo-recreation in the form of spectator sports, passive entertainment, and sedentary amusements. Ellen White laid out clear principles regarding recreation. Students must have vigorous exercise, but it should be done, whenever possible, in the open air. Sports of violence, as well as athletic games carried to excess, in addition to promoting the love of domination and the pride in mere brute force, stimulate the love of pleasure and excitement, thus fostering a distaste for useful labor, a disposition to shun practical duties and responsibilities. Parents and teachers can do much to supply diversions wholesome and life-giving, instead of frivolous associations, habits of extravagance, or pleasure-seeking. The highest form of recreation, filled with blessings to students, are those activities which make them helpful to others. The preoccupation of the mind with good is worth more than unnumbered barriers of law and discipline. Train students to be thinkers, not mere reflectors. Thinkers do more than accept passively the thinking of others. They endeavor to master what others have said or discovered. Thinkers contemplate the great facts of duty and destiny. They are masters and not slaves of circumstances, possessing breadth of mind, clearness of thought, and the courage of their convictions. How does one fulfill this lofty goal? Ellen White expressed certain principles that thinkers should understand. Thinkers understand the perils of competition. Why one wants to excel is the defining question. One of her constant themes is the call to excellence, to reach the highest level possible in whatever field of study or life work one is engaged. But a core problem of prevailing educational systems is that it urges excellence for the wrong reasons and its attainment by the wrong methods. Mrs. White asked the question, "What is the trend of the education given?" Then she answered, "To self-seeking." She described the goals of true education as the antithesis of selfish ambition, the greed for power, and selfish rivalry. She observed that traditional educational methods appeal to emulation and rivalry, and foster selfishness, the root of all evil. Strife for supremacy encourages the system of cramming, and often leads to dishonesty. By driving students to compete, discontent embitters the life, and helps to fill the world with restless, turbulent spirits. What feeds this spirit of rivalry and the desire for supremacy? Ellen White pointed to the content of much literature. Students drink from the wells of paganism, fed by the corruptions of ancient heathendom, and of how many modern authors also might the same be said. In the sciences, she saw the effects of evolution and its kindred errors that tend to infidelity. Further, she saw that the work of higher criticism is destroying faith in the Bible as a divine revelation, robbing God's word of power to control, uplift, and inspire human lives. Ellen White saw that when youth go out into the world, motivated by the assumptions of non-biblical thought, they have no barriers to meet the prevailing sentiments that desire is the highest law, that license is liberty, and that man is accountable only to himself. Youth catch the spirit of society flawed by rivalry and competition, and unless made aware of the price of competition, they have no safeguards to maintain individual integrity, purity of the home, the well-being of society, or the stability of the nation. For Ellen White, a world of difference separates excellence and competition. This distinction rests on the purpose of education, to restore the image of God in the soul. Men and women are to reach the highest possible degree of excellence, but this goal cannot be reached by a selfish and exclusive culture, for the character of God, whose likeness we are to receive, is benevolence and love. To reach the biblical goal of education, Mrs. White observed, would require a radical change in some of the current methods of education. Instead of appealing to pride and selfish ambition, kindling a spirit of emulation, teachers would endeavor to awaken the love of goodness and truth and beauty to arouse the desire for excellence. The student would seek the development of God's gifts in himself, not to excel others, but to fulfill the purpose of the Creator and to receive His likeness. The inherent flaw in using the spirit of competition to motivate students in the classroom or on the playing field, or to arouse pastors to reach certain goals and congregations to raise funds, etc., is that competition is not a principle of God's kingdom of love. Cooperation is to fulfill the purpose of education, to restore in men and women the image of their Maker. The temptation to be first would be quenched in the lessons daily learned in the school of Christ. Modern educational psychologists have recognized that competition is not a valid motivator. They point out three basic flaws. Flaw 1, that young people need competitive experiences in order to enter a competitive society. Flaw 2, that competition is an effective motivator. Granted, they say, competition is valuable as a motivator only for those people who believe that they can win. But those who do not believe that they can win are not so motivated. They are further discouraged and disillusioned. Flaw 3, the stress on competition leads to morality breakdown and to the compelling rule that the end justifies the means. Thinkers, both students and teachers, have learned that mere memorization is insufficient. Thinking is a learned event. Learning to think is a joint effort by thinking teachers and eager students. Ellen White urged Bible teachers especially to make the students understand their lessons, not by explaining everything to them, but by requiring them to explain clearly every passage they read. Let these teachers remember that little good is accomplished by skimming over the surface. Dynamic discussion with students repeating the teacher's explanations in their own language, so that it can be determined that they clearly comprehend. Their lessons may be a slow process, but it is of 10 times more value than rushing over important subjects. Not only will students better understand the subject, they will be better prepared to explain the material to others. Thinkers will appreciate a moral taste and love of work. To modern minds, this hardly seems to be a factor in developing thinkers, but it lies close to the root of Ellen White's philosophy of education. In the establishment of the Avondale School in the late 1890s, she urged a principle that she had been emphasizing for at least 20 years, that students must be educated to be masters of labor, and not slaves of labor. She wanted students to see the science in the humblest kind of work, to see nobility in labor. As we have shown on page 346, manual occupation is essential in order to balance and strengthen mental activity. Minds are abused when the physical powers are not equally taxed. Further, habits of industry will be an important aid to the youth in resisting temptation. Pent-up energies, if not expended in useful employment, will be a continual source of trial to themselves and to their teachers. For these reasons, Ellen White declared that those whose goal is to obtain a transformed mind and character will develop a new moral taste and love of work. Thinkers understand that perseverance and commitment are the price of excellence. To excel in any line of work requires an eye not easily distracted by the voice of pleasure and other diversions. Ellen White pleaded with parents and teachers to instruct young people that good intentions will not avail, that no excellence is gained without great labor. Furthermore, no great achievement is reached quickly or by ignoring present opportunities. Those who reach the height in moral and intellectual attainments must possess a brave and resolute spirit.